Hey, strangers. This week, I'm bringing you two older bonus episodes about spirits coming through from the other side to communicate with us regular folk. But as per usual with these kinds of things, the answers may be less strange and unexplained than at first glance. Enjoy. The headline of the article in the New York Times from Sunday, February 27th, 1916, read, "Patience Worth, a Psychic Mystery." The article began this way: "Genius via the Ouija board. After all the inanities and drivelings of psychic messages without number from the unknown land, would that not be an amazing outcome? Amazing enough, whatever be its explanation, is this psychic mystery of Patience Worth, whose messages out of the darkness never sink to the commonplace level, but always show high intelligence and sometimes are even tipped with the flame of genius." Amazing indeed was the story originating from St. Louis, Missouri, where 29-year-old housewife Pearl Curran had apparently opened a channel of communication between herself and a rather loquacious and prolific spirit who said her name was Patience Worth. Growing up, Pearl had been considered an average student who wasn't particularly interested in school. She dropped out of high school during her freshman year, citing a nervous breakdown due to the stress, basically, of having to go to school. Girl, same. By the time Pearl had married and moved to St. Louis, the spiritualism movement, which had been popularized in the second half of the 19th century in large part by the Fox sisters, whom I covered back in season 2, was experiencing something of a revival in the early 1910s. In 1912, Pearl and her friend Emily Grant Hutchings were visiting with another friend who brought out a Ouija board during their visit. The Ouija board was introduced to American households in the early 1890s after some businessmen caught wind of spiritualists in Ohio using homemade letter boards to communicate with the dead. Like any good capitalists, these men turned the idea into a business, got a patent and investors, and opened several factories, which pumped out the instantly popular novelty which Americans, both spiritualists and not, gladly opened their wallets for. So, that afternoon in St. Louis in 1912, the three women supposedly received a message from a dead relative of Emily Hutchings, who then instantly went out and bought a board of her own and enlisted Pearl to help her continue the conversation. Pearl was indifferent and even somewhat reluctant and had to be cajoled into participating. I don't know how often these attempted communication sessions happened, but it wasn't until more than a year later, in June of 1913, that Pearl received a message from a spirit calling themselves Pat C. I don't know what the nature of that message was, but a couple weeks later, on July 8th, Pearl received this message through the Ouija board. "Many moons ago I lived. Again I come. Patience Worth my name. Wait, I would speak with thee. If thou shalt live, then so shall I. I make my bread at thy hearth. Good friends, let us be merry. The time for work is past. Let the tabby drowse and blink her wisdom to the fire log." Patience told Pearl she came from across the sea and had emigrated to Nantucket in the late 1600s, at which point she was killed in some kind of raid involving what she called Indians. She said she lived from 1649 to 1694, and even though Pearl had never been across the sea to England, where Patience presumably was hinting was her birthplace, she said she had a picture in her mind of Patience's home. Pearl described it as, quote, "green rolling country with gentle slopes, not farmed much, with houses here and there. 2 or 3 miles up this country on this road was a small village, few houses," end quote. And though Patience didn't give any personal descriptors, Pearl said the image in her mind was, quote, "probably about 30 years. Her hair was dark red, mahogany, her eyes brown and large and deep, her mouth firm and set, as though repressing strong feelings. Her hair had been disarranged by her cap and was in big, glossy, soft waves. Sitting on a horse, holding a bundle tied in sailcloth, tied with thongs and wearing a coarse cloth cape, brown-gray, with hood like a cowl, peaked. The face is in shadow. She is small and her feet are small, with with coarse square-toed shoes and gray woolen stockings. End quote. Somehow or other, Casper S. Yost, an editor at the St. Louis Globe Democrat, caught wind of the paranormal conversations happening over at Mr. and Mrs. Curran's home, and after witnessing several sessions for himself, persuaded them to let him write about it for the paper. In 1916, a book based on the articles was published by spiritualist Henry Holt. Yost generously shared the profits of his book with Pearl and her husband. What followed was a torrent of entire novels apparently written by Patience Worth through Pearl Curran, including Telka, The Sorry Tale, Hope, True Blood, The Pot Upon the Wheel, Samuel Wheaton, An Elizabethan Mask, as well as several short stories and many poems. In 1918, William Stanley Braithwaite's Anthology of Verse and Yearbook of American Poetry printed 5 poems written by Patience/Pearl. Braithwaite also listed 88 of Patience/Pearl's poems by title in an index of notable published poems from that year. Of those 88 poems, Braithwaite mentioned only 2 that were lacking distinction. That same year, Patience Worth was named one of the outstanding authors of 1918 by the Joint Committee of Literary Arts of New York. Critic William Marion Reedy declared the story The Sorry Tale a new classic of literature. The Sorry Tale is, according to a piece by Ed Simon for Public Domain Review, quote, a more than 600-page esoteric account of the life of Christ that at points reaches a prophetic pitch calling to mind the theology of William Blake. End quote. In 1919, Pearl described the process by which she channeled the messages from Patience. She said, quote, I am like a child with a magic picture book. Once I look upon it, all I have to do is watch its pages open before me and revel in their beauty and variety and novelty. End quote. Her relationship with Patience, she said, was, quote, one of the most beautiful that can be the privilege of a human being to experience, end quote. And then came the pushback, because sure, she was claiming to communicate with a literary ghost, but also she was a woman. So, like, who did she think she was producing that much quality content? One of the arguments put forth by skeptics was that one of the novels Patience/Pearl produced was set in the Victorian era, which Patience shouldn't have had any familiarity with, having died centuries before the Victorian era began. I have to say, this argument is wacky. Like, okay, maybe ghosts can communicate with humans, but if they can, they should only know about their own time period. Then again, I assume trying to argue that ghosts aren't real in the first place is also kinda hard. Like, okay, bro, prove it. Some of the more tangible arguments against the Pearl as conduit for 17th century ghost line of thinking were about the language used by Patience, which, while it may have sounded like fun, old-fashioned type English, was mostly inventions of the author. In their 1989 book, Anomalistic Psychology, A Study of Magical Thinking, authors and psychologists Leonard Zusny and Warren H. Jones argued, quote, as to the purported 17th century English that Mrs. Curran, as Patience Worth, uses, English experts testified that it did not belong to any particular historical period, but was a mixture of contemporary English, poetic terms, and some dialect expressions, including some misused and misunderstood would-be Scottish words, and even some of her own invention. End quote. In 1919, the journal The Psychological Review published a paper titled Patience Worth by Professor of Philosophy Charles E. Corey, in which Corey attributes the so-called communication to a subconscious personality of Pearl's, essentially diagnosing Pearl with dissociative identity disorder, though I don't know if he actually ever met Pearl. If not that, he thought perhaps the knowledge poured forth in Patience/Pearl's writing was the result of unconscious knowledge that Pearl had been unknowingly carrying around. More recently, people studying this case have been unable to find any record of a woman named Patience Worth who came from England to the States in the 1600s. However, there is indeed reference to a Patience Worth in a story by Mary Johnston titled To Have and to Hold, published in The Atlantic in 1900. In Johnston's story, a young woman basically steals the identity of a woman named Patience Worth to get on a ship leaving England for America. It's perfectly reasonable to assume that Pearl had the name Patience Worth tucked away from that story. Whether or not she remembered where the name came from, or if she thought she was plucking it from her own brain, who knows? Pearl obviously denied the claims made against her. However, some believe she made a confession of sorts in a piece she published under her own name in 1919 by the Saturday Evening Post, titled Rosa Alvaro Entrante. In the story, a lonely young woman named Mamie goes to a fortune teller whom the audience can see is a fraud. The fortune teller tells Mamie she has a spirit guide named Rosa Alvaro, who is very different from Mamie. Thinking the fortune teller was right, Mamie begins slipping between her own personality and that of this made-up spirit guide. She confesses to a friend, "Oh, Gwen, I love her. She's everything I want to be. Didn't I find her? It ain't me. It's what used to be me before the world buried it." That right there seems like a bowl of pudding with the proof right in it. Incidentally, why does the proof always end up in the pudding? Like, who do I talk to figure that out? For a woman living in times when women weren't exactly encouraged to pursue an education, and whom some believe was further academically stymied by her mother, in addition to being one for whom conventional education didn't seem to work, perhaps she knew she needed an alter ego in order to be taken seriously. Someone that used to be her before the world buried it. Maybe she knew that having some kind of hook might make getting published easier. She wouldn't have been the first or the last woman to assume a different identity for the purposes of getting published. In fact, she joins a long list of celebrated writers who adopted typically male or gender-neutral nom de plume, such as the Bronte sisters and Louisa May Alcott. I mean, look at Marianne Evans, who, writing as George Eliot, penned Middlemarch, which is still considered one of the greatest novels of all time. Out of Africa author Isaac Dinesen was actually Karen Blixen. And of course, there's notorious TERF J.K. Rowling, along with many more. And right or wrong, Patience Worth likely did get far more attention than Pearl Curran ever would have. Even if the product had been exactly the same, chances are the literary world would have been like, "Another woman author? We already published one this decade. If we publish another, they'll get the wrong idea. If all these women are writing, what's next? Becoming scientists? Doctors? Why, who's going to make our dinner?" Ask yourself this. If the Wachowski sisters had come out as trans before they got The Matrix made, do you think anyone would have bothered reading that script? I mean, if this show were Strange and Unexplained with David Egan, maybe fewer people would DM me telling me they're going to make it their life's purpose to ruin my career, or that my son will grow up to hate me, or that some of the topics are stupid, but they still think I'm hot. You see what I'm saying? The spiritualist movement was unique in that many lauded mediums and psychics were women, and it opened up opportunities for women to make money in a world that was overwhelmingly dominated by men. Perhaps Pearl Curran seized the moment and used it to her advantage. Ironically, though, while Patience Worth was the name that put Pearl Curran on the map and is the reason people still talk about her today, it was Pearl's Rosa Alvaro Entrada, which she published under her own name, which garnered the most attention in her day. The story was optioned by the Goldwyn Company and made into a film. In a letter to a friend, Pearl wrote, "I got word Saturday that it was sold for $1,500. To the Goldwyn Film Company. Oh, my dears, can you imagine? And that is not all. The Famous Players Movie Company have written that they are tremendously interested in my stuff and want me to submit any and all stories to them. I can hardly believe my eyes. They tell me there is a world of future for me if I won't get foolish." What the fuck did that mean? There is a world of future for you if you won't get foolish? Was this film company really passive-aggressively telling Pearl to stay in her place? Am I passive-aggressively shaming the film company? The film was released in 1920 and was well received, but ultimately nothing more came from Pearl's writing. It was still Patience Worth's words that people flocked to Pearl to hear. In fact, Pearl and her husband claimed to have lost money in the whole affair. For some reason, they weren't profiting from the novels, or it may have been that their expenses outweighed their income. They had started a magazine called Patience Worth in order to promote Patience's writing, and Pearl's husband claimed that between that venture and the cost of entertaining the thousands of people who came calling to witness the medium and her spirit muse, they'd lost tens of thousands of dollars. Things got worse for Pearl when her husband died in 1922. Before he passed, thinking she was infertile, the couple had adopted a child who was still very young when Pearl became pregnant. That child was born 6 months after her husband died, leaving Pearl a widow with two young children. To support herself and her children, Pearl traveled the country giving demonstrations of her communications with patients. She was briefly married to a widowed physician, but then moved to Los Angeles, where she met and married her third husband, Robert Wyman, in 1931. According to a piece on the Smithsonian website, quote, "In California, Pearl was the idol of a group of artsy women who maintained the belief that spiritual visions were sources of female power," end quote. And for the record, I would absolutely join that club. But aside from the early profits, Pearl never made a real living off the writing she did through her communications with patients, despite the fact that her works were critically lauded. And then, on November 25, 1937, Pearl told a friend that patients told her she wouldn't live very much longer. Very shortly after that, Pearl contracted pneumonia and died on December 3, 1937. Look, I've said it before and I'll say it again. If there's one thing doing this podcast for the last few years has taught me, it's that I am not in a position to definitively declare one way or another if paranormal phenomena exist. I used to think it was all a lot of hooey, but I'm less sure these days. It could be that some people can receive messages from somewhere else, although I can say that I don't believe that those messages would come through a board with letters written on it. I'd be more inclined to believe they might use a system of Christmas lights and letters painted on a wall. I just find it hard to believe that a slew of spirits were waiting for some guy to take advantage of the spiritualist movement and make what is, essentially, a parlor game with letters and a pointer that requires people's hands to work. You know? But one thing I do know for sure is that women's voices have been silenced for centuries, so I wouldn't fault a woman for finding pretty much any way to get her voice heard. Whether or not Pearl Curran actually believed the spirit of a woman with a very unusual name that happened to be the same name as a character in a romance novel was using her as a vessel to get out her stories, or if she invented patience so people might pay attention, I don't know. And I don't really care. No one was harmed. And in the end, no one even really benefited. So congrats to Pearl for either being a medium to the spirit world or being cunning enough to pretend to be. Either way, we're still talking about her today, almost a century after her death. And that, after all, is a true accomplishment. Thanks for joining me on Patreon. Strange and Unexplained is a production of the Obsessed Network. This episode was produced by Natalie Grillo and Angela Palladino. It was researched and written by me, Daisy Egan, and sound engineered and mixed by Angela Palladino. My sources for this episode were the Smithsonian Magazine, Medium, AmericanHauntings.com, The Skeptic's Dictionary, The Public Domain Review, and Wikipedia. See you next time. If you've ever visited Salem, Massachusetts, home to the epicenter of the witch panic that was most likely the result of moldy crops in early colonial America, you're likely to see at least four young women dressed like Stevie Nicks and a guy wearing tight black pants and big black boots and probably black suspenders over a black t-shirt with a pentagram on it, strolling hand in hand into one of the many so-called witch shops the town plays host to. If you do venture into one of those witch shops, which you can easily find by following the trail of patchouli left behind by one of the Hot Topic Stevie Nicks types, you will find questionably sourced crystals and sage, all manner of incense, coffin-shaped earrings, mood rings, and, of course, Ouija boards. I asked the person with a lot of eyeliner and piercings behind the counter if they were worried about being so close to all those Ouija boards. "Aren't you afraid of all the evil spirits that can come through the Ouija boards?" said I.
"They have to be invited," the clerk said.
I was only kidding. They were not. The Ouija board, as we know it today, was the result of a couple of enterprising businessmen in Baltimore who seized on the popularity of the American spiritualist movement of the mid-1800s. Apparently, mediums in Ohio had started using talking boards to communicate with spirits. By 1886, news about these so-called talking boards had hit mainstream newspapers. In Chestertown, Maryland, Charles Kennard, who was mostly a failed businessman, worked across the hall from a coffin maker turned undertaker named E.C. Reich. The two men teamed up to design a commercial talking board. Once they had a design they liked, Kennard, who was not known to be the most honest of dudes, took the board and moved to Baltimore, where he started shopping it around as his own sole invention. Kennard eventually met Elijah Bond, a young attorney who said his sister-in-law, Helen Peters, was a strong medium who could test the board out to see if it did what it purported to do. Helen asked the board what it should be called, and it replied Ouija, which the board said meant good luck. Some people believe Ouija is the French and German words for yes put together, though most stories say Helen was wearing a necklace that either said Ouija or Ouida, which I guess might have been someone's name. Either way, none of it explains the biggest mystery of all surrounding the Ouija board. Why is it pronounced Ouija if it's spelled Ouija? Anyway, the team took the board and Helen Peters to the patent office, where Helen demonstrated its veracity, whereupon the patent clerk was so stunned, he gave them a patent, declaring that he didn't know how it worked, but he knew that it worked. The Ouija board was a massive success. By 1890, they were selling 2,000 boards per week. People were gaga for Ouija. At some point in their first few years in business, an employee and investor in the Kennard Novelty Company, William Fuld, took control of the company when one of the founders cashed out. Apparently, William's brother Isaac also had a stake in the company, which William fought in court to take as well. Once Isaac was no longer in the picture, Fuld went on to make millions on the game. Isaac was so pissed that apparently he had his baby daughter exhumed from the family plot and relocated. In 1927, at the age of 56, Fuld fell to his death from the roof of the factory he'd claimed the Ouija board told him to build. In the fall, one of his ribs had broken and pierced his heart, and on his deathbed, he made his family swear to never sell the company. But of course they did, because there's no such thing as legacy wealth unless you're a literal billionaire. Sorry, but your mere millions aren't going to last, especially not when your widowed wife uses it to buy a villa in Italy and employ a bevy of hot young household help, and then your grandson Billy snorts what's left up his nose. For the record, I just made that up. I don't know what happened to Fuld's millions. That's just what I imagine happens to every millionaire's heirs. I don't know. We Egans and Boroffs have only ever been thousandaires, at best. Anyway, about 40 years after Fuld's death, the family sold the company to Parker Brothers. And sometime after that, Hasbro bought the trademarks for a whole bunch of games, including the Ouija board. Over the years, several authors claimed to have used the Ouija board as an automatic writing tool in their work, getting messages from the great beyond. In addition to Pearl Curran / Patience Worth, whom I covered in the last bonus episode, notable writers like Sylvia Plath, Dialogue Over a Ouija Board, and Pulitzer Prize winner James Merrill used the board in consultations for a 560-page poem. That spirit might have wanted to tell him to rein it in a little bit. A 560-page poem? I mean, really. In 1917, a woman named Emily Grant Hutchings published a novel called Jap Heron, which she claimed Mark Twain dictated to her via a Ouija board. You might remember Hutchings from the Patience Worth episode. She was the one who essentially introduced Pearl Curran to the Ouija board. It seems that once Pearl got success through Patience Worth, Hutchings was like, oh yeah? Well, I talked to Mark Twain. Checkmate. Mark Twain's daughter, Clara Clemens, was not having that and sued Hutchings, who eventually had to destroy all existing copies and cease further publications. So, set and match, or whatever they say at the end of chess. The Ouija board remained a popular parlor game for decades, with spiritualists and children alike amusing themselves for hours by definitely not moving the pointer around the board themselves. And at some point, shit started to get weird. In 1972, William Blatty, author of The Exorcist, claimed in an interview that a Ouija board opened up some kind of paranormal hullabaloo in his life while he was finishing the book. Phones ringing literally off the hook. I think I covered it in my Exorcist episode in season one, but honestly, that might as well have been a century ago. Anyway, it was spooky stuff. The Exorcist was, I think, the first mainstream movie to make mention of a Ouija board. Reagan tells her mom that Captain Howdy talks to her through her Ouija board, and the next thing you know, she's putting a crucifix up her hoo-ha and vomiting out pea soup. That movie and Blatty's claim of weird experiences with a Ouija board, coupled with a shift in attitudes about religion around that time, especially with the Catholic Church, and the cult of personality around the Ouija board began to shift. For some. In the ensuing 50 years, the mystique of the Ouija board grew. As far as I know, the game itself doesn't come with a set of instructions. Nonetheless, a long list of do's and mostly don'ts has grown over the years. They include, never use the board alone. Never use the board in a cemetery. Never use the board in your home. In fact, the Sci-Fi Channel website, extremely reputable source by the way, suggests never using the board at all because of all the evil spirits and stuff. But if you have to, certainly don't use it in your home because you'll be inviting those spirits in. Evil spirits are hard to get rid of. It's not something you can solve with a couple sprays of Febreze. Better yet, as the Sci-Fi Channel recommends, use the Ouija board out in the woods by a campfire, perhaps. Because, you know, nothing scary ever happens out in the fucking woods. Just make sure there isn't a cemetery nearby. You must always end a Ouija session by closing the channel by saying goodbye. Listen, evil spirits may be evil, but they're not rude, and they certainly don't cotton to rude behavior. Just a simple goodbye and they'll leave you alone. They'll be like, oh man, I was really hoping to haunt this one, but they said goodbye. Rats, foiled again. Never use a Ouija board when you're sick or incapacitated because a weak body leaves you more susceptible to possession. Also, apparently, evil spirits are kind enough to give warnings that they're trying to communicate. Like the villain of a film giving his monologue about how he intends to take over the world, giving the hero enough time to figure out how to get out of the handcuffs and kill him. If the spirit starts going through the alphabet or counting down, it's evil. Say goodbye immediately. If the spirit makes a figure eight or infinity sign, it's evil. Say goodbye immediately. If the spirit says their name is Zozo, it's definitely evil. Say goodbye immediately. This way, the spirit will not be able to leave the board, but instead will be stuck in there and its friends will be like, damn it, Zozo, what did I tell you last time? Stop warning them. Remember, tell them your name is Sarah. No one ever suspects a Sarah. These days, there's any number of movies that employ a Ouija board as a catalyst for spooky shit, including the 2014 cinematic gem Ouija Board, which I tried to watch but was so bored by a half hour in that I gave up on it. Which is saying a lot because I was watching mainly to procrastinate writing this script. A movie has to be pretty bad for me to abandon procrastinating. Now, I'm no religious historian, but I'd venture to guess that most mainstream Judeo-Christian religions have generally frowned upon things like seances and the like. It's one thing to talk to God in prayer. It's quite another to invite your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, Jarvis Cheeseman, actual name of one of my great times six or so grandfathers, which finally explains my borderline inappropriate love affair with cheese, to talk to you through a board that's mass-produced by a board game company. And call me jaded, but I just find it slightly hard to believe that a game made out of cardboard that comes out of the same place that makes Mr. Potato Head can do anything more than reduce a room full of 9-year-old girls to tears when they start accusing each other of making the board say, Susie pees her pants and Sally eats her boogers, you know? It turns out that recently, scientists ran some tests that tracked the eye movement of people using Ouija boards to show that people look at a letter or number before the planchette moves to it, strongly indicating that the planchette is not, in fact, moving on its own, but that someone's fingers on the planchette are, indeed, moving it themselves. However, I don't think that will matter much to people who believe in the principle behind the Ouija board. I was discussing Ouija boards with a friend of mine who believes in connections between the spirit world and ours, a little more freely than I do, and I floated the idea of collecting vintage Ouija boards to line a wall in my office with. She made a face, and I said, "You're right, it would probably make the wall look too cluttered." But that, apparently, was not her concern. "You're just inviting a lot of unknown energy into your space," she explained. I told her about how I refuse to believe people hang around their stuff from life after they've died, but she, and plenty of others, I assume, believes that some of our energy stays with everything we touch. I think. Listen, I was a few margaritas in when we were having this conversation, so the details are fuzzy. But her view pretty much is that we stick to shit we interact with, I guess, and after we die, before we go to heaven or hell, a part of our spirit is still with said shit. I suppose technically that means you could invite spirits through any object at all as long as it once belonged to someone who is now dead. Which, you know, that I can maybe buy, but a Ouija board that came straight off the factory belt wrapped in plastic? Whose spirit got attached to that? And when? I'm not sure I believe that using a board game that comes shrink-wrapped in plastic will open a portal to demons or whatever. I'm almost 100% positive that lining a wall with Ouija boards is safe, especially if I coat them in lacquer. Surely spirits can't come through a coat of lacquer, right? But I do understand why people who tend to believe in these kinds of things might think you're better off leaving well enough alone. Sure, maybe a board game you can order through Amazon can't actually be a portal to another dimension, but, you know, it's like smoking pot or getting a tattoo. It's just a matter of time before you're dropping out of society. Next thing you know, you're a white person with dreads living on a pot farm covered head to toe in tattoos with a brood of children with names like Starchild and Moonbeam. No offense, Frank Zappa. The Ouija board is a gateway drug. Sure, today it's just a Ouija board, but tomorrow you'll be wearing floor-length velvet gowns even in the middle of July with a pentagram pendant around your neck and too much eyeliner, making minimum wage behind the counter of a witch shop in a town that literally murdered innocent people and is now capitalizing on that history by selling occult-themed knickknacks, spending your free time smudging the Ouija boards on display next to the money candles, you know, just in case. But what if? What if, stranger, something were to get mixed up at the Hasbro factory with the Ouija board machine and the Mr. Potato Head machine, and right now, as we speak, thousands of Mr. Potato Heads with the potential to open a portal to hell are being shipped to little kids all around the world. Thanks for joining me on Patreon. Strange and Unexplained is a production of the Obsessed Network. This episode was produced by Natalie Grillo and Angela Palladino. It was researched and written by me, Daisy Egan, and sound engineered and mixed by Angela Palladino. My sources for this episode were Wikipedia, Library of Congress, Baltimore Magazine, JSTORDaily.com, Smithsonian Magazine, Britannica.com, Sci-Fi.com, Discover Magazine, and PsychologicalScience.org. Thank you.
Next time on Strange and Unexplained, in the early part of the 20th century, a young woman rose to unprecedented heights using nothing but her charm and wits, and some very good business management from her mother. But sometimes the wealth and power we build around us can become a gilded cage. Part 1 of 2, The Rise of Amy Semple McPherson. This episode was researched and written by me, Daisy Egan, with sound engineering by Angela Palladino, extra audio engineering by Jeff Devine. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.